Back in March, we were looking at the weeks and months ahead with great anticipation. We just wrapped up a wonderful men's retreat and gotten a huge batch of Easter eggs in for Egg Fest. And Easter was just around the corner. As a family, Amy and I were looking forward to flying west to see family. Amy's sister was about ready to have her first baby, and grandma's aunts, uncles, and cousins had yet to meet our three-month-old Sam. We all had plenty of toilet paper, and we weren't thinking about where we were going to buy a new roll next. March seems like forever ago, doesn't it? Since then, COVID has swept through southern New Hampshire, affecting how we go about work, go about our daily business, and attend church. We've had to put relationships on hiatus and keep family at a distance. Mental health is on the decline. This is perhaps the first time for many of us where all in this together, it means to stay at least 6 feet apart. So many people met the challenge with optimism, but as weeks turned into months, things got harder. When we wait for too long, we become weary and start to lose hope. Chances are some of you found yourself wondering whether God really cares. And you didn't think that, and if you didn't think that question, maybe you at least felt it. With everything that's going on in the world and with all that we've faced, many are wondering if celebrating Christmas is the right response to 2020. As troubling as these times might be, if the good news of Christmas isn't good enough for 2020, then it's not really good enough. Is it possible that Christmas can help us find a reason to rejoice again, to bring joy to our parenting, joy to our workplaces, happiness to our relationships, even in the midst of uncertain times? And how can Christmas help us rejoice again? Perhaps the very first Christmas has something to say about it. At the time Jesus was born, the Jewish people were living under a hostile Roman government. Religious people were beginning to doubt the goodness of God since the stories of God's intervention had happened so long ago. Now, poverty was rampant, and it caused hostile divisions among classes. Religious and political groups had begun to fracture. Things were bad for so long that when a Roman governor ordered the execution of a bunch of firstborn baby boys, the world didn't even bat an eye. The nation of Israel was weary. There's a good chance you know the story. The emperor called for a worldwide census. So Mary and Joseph headed toward Bethlehem to register. Bethlehem was a small, sleepy town, but it was buzzing because of the census. That meant that the young couple couldn't find an appropriate place to stay. But Mary was very pregnant, and Jesus was not going to wait for the trip back to Nazareth. So Jesus was born and laid in a manger, a simple trough for feeding animals. Mary and Joseph were alone in Joseph's place of ancestry, separated from the people they knew back in Nazareth. There were no friends and family to visit them, just a group of local shepherds they didn't know, who were probably a little smelly from working the sheep. They said that angels told them that the Messiah would be there. It all probably felt a little bit strange. It wasn't basking in the warm glow of the Christmas star like we're used to hearing about. The Magi wouldn't make their visit for months later. It didn't seem like conditions fitting for a Savior and King. It was simple, austere, perhaps a little disappointing. It's possible that Placide Capu felt similar about the world that he was living in the night that a priest approached him to pen a poem for the Christmas Eve Mass in honor of their recommissioned organ. It was 1847, the eve of the French Revolution of 1848. Just a year earlier, France had gone through a terrible economic crisis. A bad harvest combined with a poor rail system that hindered relief efforts resulted in peasant rebellions that were quickly crushed by an oppressive government. France was under the power of a constitutional monarchy at the time, but only 1% of the population could vote. And those that could vote were the wealthy elite. Unrest was boiling hot. And yet Capu saw something different in the Christmas story. Its simplicity was an invitation for the overlooked, the downtrodden, the broken. He drew his inspiration from the Gospel of Luke to write, "Minuit Chrétiens." As some of the lines include the following: "People on your knees, await your deliverance. Christmas, Christmas, here is the Redeemer. O mighty ones of today, proud of your greatness, bow your heads before the Redeemer." The Redeemer has broken every bond. He sees a brother where there was only a slave. Love unites those whom iron had chained. Capu's poem was put to music by Adolph Adams, and a short few years later it found its way across the pond to an abolitionist minister in Boston by the name of John Sullivan Dwight in the twilight of the Civil War. Dwight was captivated by the music and its revolutionary sentiments, so he went about adapting it to English. His version sang, "Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease." O Holy Night was an act of defiance that became one of the most popular Christmas carols of all time. Legend has it that fighting temporarily ceased during the Franco-Prussian War as French soldiers sang the original version across the battlefield to their opponents. It was the first song ever sent over radio airwaves. One of my favorite lines is this: "Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he'd appeared and the soul felt its worth." Whoever thought that the worth of the soul was something we ought to feel in the first place? But chances are, on that fateful night when angels appeared before shepherds in Bethlehem, those shepherds got a taste of that very thing. It's really quite odd that the gospel writer Luke chose to tell the story through shepherds in the first place. Luke was an educated man writing to a person of some social prominence. He breaks one of the key rules of writing, or at least he seems to, knowing your audience. If he wanted Theophilus to relate more to the birth of Jesus, why not tell the story of the Magi instead, like the Gospel of Matthew does? How could Theophilus possibly relate to a group of blue-collar shepherds? Well, it turns out that these common shepherds probably had the same questions as the most excellent Theophilus. "God, do you see me? Could I possibly be forgiven for all that I've done? Could someone like me possibly have a place at your table?" Look at how the shepherds respond when the angels first show up in Luke chapter 2, verse 8. "And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified." Of course they would be terrified. This wasn't the first time angels had visited. Angels had delivered good news to their forefather Abraham. They had come to support the great military leader Joshua. But when had angels visited shepherds? Angelic visits weren't always pleasant encounters. There's a good chance that the first thing that the shepherds thought was, "Uh-oh, what did we do wrong?" Luke continues, "But the angel said to them, 'Do not be afraid. I bring good news that will cause great joy for all people. Today in the town of David has been born to you a Savior. He is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find the baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger.'" Good news had arrived, the kind of news that would cause great joy for everyone. But as global and as big as that news was, it was still personal. A Savior had been born not just for the world, but for the shepherds. "A Savior has been born to you," the angel says. "And you're going to find him lying in a feeding trough." Now that's a good sign. What other newborn in Bethlehem would they find lying in a feeding trough? And yet, as clear and amazing as a sign as that would be, did you notice what just happened? The shepherds were invited to be the first to see Jesus aside from Mary and Joseph. Luke records no angels at the manger. The Magi would not show up until much later. A privilege and honor normally reserved for close family was granted to common people like you and me. They had been made part of the family. And the invitation extends to us too. In the Broadway musical Hamilton, Aaron Burr sings a number called "The Room Where It Happens." It's a turning point for the character of sorts. Up until then, he has kept his wants and desires close to the vest. He's tried to be as neutral as possible, serving as a foil to the more outspoken and opinionated Alexander Hamilton. But partway through the second act, we see him observing a secret deal being brokered between Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And we learn that what he has wanted all along is to be in the room where it happens. He wants to be at the table. He wants to be included. He wants to be someone. He wants to be accepted, recognized, and to be seen. As some of you may know that Burr's failed attempt to bring that about in his own way and in his own terms and in disastrous results. But what if he turned somewhere else to find that belonging instead? There's a part of all of us that wants to be in the room. We want to have a seat at the table. We want to be included. We want to be part of something because that tells us we're valued, we're seen, we matter, we belong. And in spite of all the mess we bring to the table, when God stepped into the world and invited the lowest to be part of his family, he was sending a message that he was inviting everyone. He appeared and the soul felt its worth. As we make our way through this weary world, isn't that the message that we need to keep us afloat? Don't we need a sense of the significance that God has given us to press through another monotonous Zoom call? To wait a little bit longer to be connected with the people that we love in a normal way again. To press on through the uncertainty that life can bring. We may still be 6 feet apart this Christmas Eve, but God is drawing us closer to him than ever before. No matter who you are and how isolated you might feel this Christmas, you have been given the chance to be a part of a family that doesn't end. Christmas is a reason for weary souls to rejoice because this is the night God has invited us to belong. Tonight, as we close our services, I want to invite you to pick up a candle and light it as we sing this closing song together and reflect a little on this timeless story that still speaks to us today. What would it have been like to be invited to that first Christmas? What does it mean to know that you have been invited to be a part of the family of God? What would God say to those parts of you that feel cautious, afraid, hurt, or alone? What would it feel like for your soul to experience its full worth as part of the family of God?